Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to, hopefully enjoy. So I haven't done a podcast for a while. It's because I've been super busy. I've been working and doing stuff at home, and also I went to the European Juggling Convention, which I go to every year. I think long-term listeners of this podcast will recognise that there's always a bit of a break in the summer for a few weeks as I do that and travel around and things like that, and that was a lot of fun this time. And I thought, hey, I might be able to, you know, while I'm there, I thought I might be able to record some podcasts while I was in my hotel room and away from everyone else, but it turns out that I was just way too busy having fun and juggling, and actually I was a lot less busy than normal, because normally I'm part of the organization team, but this time I wasn't. I was just hanging out doing my own thing. So let's get on to a book that I actually finished reading quite a while ago, and it's going to be a slightly different kind of podcast as normal, because I read this book in July, but I didn't read it because, hey, this is a book that I've always wanted to read. It's a book that I read before, and it's called Splinter of the Mind's Eye, by Alan Dean Foster, and it's a Star Wars book. It's called a classic. I'm just looking here on the goodreads.com page, and this is a classic Star Wars, Splinter of the Mind's Eye, and it was it's released on Kindle, so I read it as an ebook. And the reason I read this is because I'm working on a different project where I'm comparing, it's a book project where I'm going to be comparing the textual history of the New Testament with the sort of history of the Star Wars movies. And while most of it I'm concentrating on the movies of Star Wars and the editing and the re-editing of that and the creation of it and the source materials and things like that, where it comes from, I thought I needed to look at different visions of what came both before and after Star Wars Episode One, to contrast with what became before and after the Book of Mark. So if you take take it that the Book of Mark in the New Testament was written first, Mark starts with Jesus coming on as an adult, and you don't get any of the nativity or anything like that. And it ends, the earliest documents ends with him, with Jesus dying, but you don't see him after he dies. He's risen from the dead, but you don't see him. And then it's like, well, what happens afterwards? And Matthew and Luke both take a stab in the dark. Both of them had read Mark, but not read each of the other books. They haven't read each other's documents. So Luke has a totally different story of Jesus's nativity and resurrection appearances, and Matthew has a totally, you know, he's got another one, he's got his own version, and some of the facts line up, you know, like where Jesus was born or where his hometown was from, but most of the other facts don't line up at all. So what I was trying to do is find examples of other people, of other stories which are written about, you know, what happened either before or after the Star Wars Episode 4, which is the first one, to contrast with actually the later version, the later, like, what is really thought to have happened in George Lucas's mind, compared to what other people thought. So, of course, the background of this book is that George Lucas wrote the story of Star Wars, and it was released as a novel, I think under the name, it was ghostwritten for him by Alan Dean Foster, but it was released under the name George Lucas. And then another book was written. Alan Dean Foster was contracted to write another book, and the way that this book was written was, going to Wikipedia, and it says here, it goes, Foster's contract also required a second novel to be used as a basis for a low budget sequel to Star Wars, in case Star Wars was not successful. And it says he was granted a great deal of leeway in developing the story. A key requirement that of many of the props from the previous production could be reused in the shooting of the film. And also it mentions in the foreword, or the introduction to this book in the ebook, it said that, is it the author's note afterwards? I can't remember which way around it was. But they had certain characters, certain actors signed up to play in a sequel if the sequel came up, like Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher. So they were definitely going to be in any sequel that happened. They were definitely going to be in there. Harrison Ford, not so much. Of course, Obi-Wan Kenobi, not so much. So what happens is that he's got this outline. He knows which characters he's got to include, and he knows the props and the other bits and pieces, and it has to be low budget. And so what this is a story of, it's like the overarching story is there's Luke and Leia, and they go and they crash land on a planet, and then they discover a crystal. Called the Kyber Crystal, and then they've got to go and find it, and that's it. And this crystal is a force multiplication sort of like little widget, which again wasn't mentioned in Star Wars, but apparently it was mentioned in some early scripts of Star Wars. But they had that, and some other characters come in, and you got some big Wookiee-like creatures, which are big hairy things. They're there, and I'm guessing they're going to reuse or like refurbish the Wookiee costume. And Darth Vader turns up as this kind of thing, and there's stormtroopers and this and that and this, and it's just they go through and. And it's to be honest, the story is not very good at all. I mean, I could talk a lot about like the story and going into it. It's really not worth it. This book is only, I think, worth reading as a historical kind of curiosity of a story which is written for a low budget sequel to Star Wars. But then, of course, Star Wars made a lot of money, and George Lucas obviously went for his big budget follow up and sort of the story that he really wanted to tell. And people say, oh, wait, this shows that George Lucas didn't have a bigger story in mind and he didn't know what the characters were doing. No, this is the point. This was his plan B. If Star Wars didn't make a lot of money, he would have gone with this. I do believe that he had a larger story in mind. I think that changed a lot over the years, but I do think there was a larger story in mind. But of course, as the great characters in Star Wars came up, of course Han Solo had to come back in. Of course the Millennium Falcon had to be there, and Darth Vader was going to play a bigger and bigger part through like in each subsequent movie, going through into the prequel trilogies as well. So what was I going to talk about before? Oh yeah, so getting into this, the writing is actually really interesting in a very, 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 very bad way, except that it does contrast quite a bit with my Red Shirts review, and I mentioned this, I think, in my Red Shirts review of John Scholes' Red Shirts, is there he just goes, oh, and there's a starship, I'm not going to explain it because we all know that it looks like this and that and this and that. And for there, I thought that was quite bad writing because for a lot of people, it's meant to be an exact copy of Star Trek, but yet we were told that Star Trek also exists in the Red Shirts universe and that it wasn't Star Trek. So we were never actually told what was going on there. So even the main ship, we didn't know. It was in this. It literally says here that he had to use the same props from the previous production with the same starships and the same this and the same that and this and this. And so he just goes, right, okay, so we're going to have an X-Wing. Don't need to write about that because everybody reading this book is a fan of the movie. Of course, everyone's a fan of Star Wars in 1979 or whenever this book was released. That's a strange thing. But otherwise, the writing of this book is just terrible. Absolutely terrible. I could mention some examples, but it's really hardly even worth talking because in the movie, what's so great is the economy of the writing in the movie. There's like very few characters ever say anything which doesn't progress the plot forward or doesn't give some information that you need to know. And the introduction of Darth Vader, it's like, ah, Vader, only you could be so bold. It's one of the great introductions because it like wraps up everything you need to know about that character in this one statement. And also that statement shows Leia's defiance and it's just so great. But it's just the dialogue. It just rambles on and on and on and on. Anytime that someone can use like five words to get across a major plot point, you have an entire conversation. And each one of those sentences in that entire conversation is people saying things in the longest way possible. Actually, I'm going to maybe in this Kindle app, let's see if I made some notes. I might have made some bookmarks. Oh, no, I just bookmarked something else. Let me have a look here. And you get all these. She commented enthusiastically. And lots of those, there's things. What am I looking for as well? An invasion force. Oh, wait, I can't even. So they're talking about this. They go into this cave and there's this little sort of like Ewok session going off. you know, I think Luke says, I wish I had your confidence in Aboriginal jurisprudence, Haller. And I'm thinking, wait a second, is this Luke Skywalker saying, Luke Skywalker actually say, I wish I had your confidence in Aboriginal jurisprudence? And I'm not even sure what that means. And it seems something very, very much from this thing. I'm trying to find the bookmarks aren't actually very well very well done. One second. I expect no such difficulty in restraining myself where you are concerned, Leia Organa. Actually, I can't even remember the bad. When I'm looking at the page and I'm trying to find the example of the bad writing that I put a bookmark in for, I can't see it because even when I read through, it's all so bad. This is what I'm saying. This is Darth Vader. Darth Vader, he talks in these long paragraphs. It's not just the short, like, I am your father, you know, he doesn't just say stuff. And there's nothing written about his voice, so I'm thinking this was probably written before Darth Vader's voice was dubbed over, and it was written, like, before the character of Darth Vader became as he is known now. Of course, he does talk quite a lot, but he doesn't ramble on. You know, he's a character of very few words, which is brought into the... to the fore in The Return of the Jedi when he throws the Emperor off the down the hole, and he does it all without talking, and that's why it's so bad now that in the latest Blu-ray edit he's going no, it's not in the Blu-ray edit, it's the latest 3D edit that's come back in the cinemas, he actually says no as he does it. And the point of Darth Vader is that he can, even with his mask on, that he can portray so much without saying no that. And so there's all the controversy surrounding that. So the writing is absolutely terrible. The action sequences, strangely enough, it's written as though it's a movie. So a lot of the action sequences are very movie-like, which in some cases in the middle of the book it gets a bit silly because there's just a monster. What's happening? There's a monster. And what does it add? Nothing. What does it do? Nothing. Why is it here? Doesn't matter. Why is it there? Well, it's a monster and we didn't need a monster. Unlike, say, the monster fight at the start of The Return of the Jedi, where the whole point of that is to show how great Luke is, you know, at the Force, and he can use his ingenuity, and he's going to need this later on and do this. You know, it's to show how far he's progressed, and the what's the other monsters there, you know, with the monster in the, that they go inside the monster with the Millennium Falcon, and all these other monsters, they seem to have like more plot points and plot function than just, oh, and let's have a monster here, okay, let's have a monster, which is what you get from this. But then at the end, there's this whole like action sequence, and it's described really well as though Alan Dean Foster was like, oh yeah, this will make it into the movie. Oh, of course, this, you know, when they do this action sequence at the end, this is what they're going to do, of course. And so quite a bit of the action later on is surprisingly not shit. Otherwise, in the story, you've got the whole love thing going on between the relationship developing between Luke and Leia, which is weird to say the least, but only as we read back, of course. You know, if you just take it as a different part of the world. Some other things that I made notes of, the questions, which are kind of like not answered in the movie, the things that we all love speculating on. And this is really the reason that I read this book, is because I wanted to find out, back even before the movie came out, because this book was written, I think, before Star Wars was released, the what people would be speculating on. And the focus is really like what the reading experience is of Mark, if you don't know Luke or Matthew or John or anything like that, compared to like what the viewing experience of Star Wars is, and the questions and what you speculate on Star Wars if you haven't seen the Empire Strikes Back or all any of the other movies. And you know, and it's sort of like this kind of reader response kind of criticism, where you're actually like, what throughout time, as you're reading, as you're watching a movie or reading a book or anything like that, what are your responses? Not at the very end of consuming the entire saga or the entire trilogy or the entire two trilogies. What is it once you read through and to the end of the first one? And reading novels, novelizations, which sort of came out between movies, either between the first and second movie or between the first and second trilogy, is a good way to check that out. Of course, with the Bible, we have what the questions are what needed answered in Mark, like what was brought up, which needed clarifying. We get two different people's responses to that. We get Luke and Matthew. They both read Mark and they both add in new stuff and solve problems and clarify things in the way that they think should be clarified, and they get two different things. And here we get Alan Dean Foster's take on the first movie and what he thinks needs clarifying and where he thinks the story should be going. Of course, with budget constraints. And in the Empire Strikes Back, we get like George Lucas's plus Lawrence Kasdan as the scriptwriter, and there was another scriptwriter for that which I've forgotten her name now, but of course there's different things that sort of came into it that were put into two different versions of what could have happened afterwards. And and one thing that I thought was quite interesting was what happened to Obi-Wan Kenobi? He disappeared when he dies, and that's one of those things that, you know, it wasn't just that Vader killed Obi-Wan Kenobi, is that he killed him and actually sort of Obi-Wan kind of sacrificed himself in this weird thing, and it was so weird that like everyone of course at the time was like, well, where did he go? He disappeared. What happened there? And of course we do find out about it in Empire Strikes Back, whereas in A Splinter of the Mind's Eye, that's one of the things which isn't answered, but it's kind of like hinted at. It's sort of Luke is going, wow, well, where did he go? I don't know, where did he go? And it isn't answered, but I like it that that is one of the big questions that comes up. And of course we do find out kind of where he went. We find out in the second and third movies, or episode 5 and 6, to put it that way. And I also like the idea of having a gem that makes the Force stronger. And this is the splinter in a splinter of the mind's eye. There's a little like the mind's eye is this Kyber crystal, and one person has a splinter of it, and that kind of boosts Luke Skywalker's Force power kind of thing. And I like the idea of having something which can boost someone's Force. So here we have a gem which can do it, sort of like a gem. And it's a bit weird. It's like a gem is like a non-living thing but can boost the power of the Force, and you're not quite sure. Whereas in episode 1 of Star Wars, we get the midichlorians, and he's got a 10,000 midichlorian count, which is higher than even Master Yoda, and you get that kind of thing. And so I really like these two different takes on it. One by Alan Dean Foster, and one, I guess it's by Alan Dean Foster, and the other one purely out of the mind of George Lucas. And you realise, oh, George, you should have gone with a gem. You should have had, like, when Anakin was young, he accidentally swallowed a piece of this gem and it's inside him. And that would have been better than midichlorians, to have some kind of thing on Tatooine, and maybe some dust in the ground, which is, you know, which comes from the same material as this gem, which boosts Force power, and that's what Luke Skywalker got. And that's what, I don't know, it's a weird thing, but you could have taken it in that word. There's some strange other things that they have here, which is the lightsaber. In Star Wars, we find about the lightsaber is just, you press the button, it turns on, you press the button, it turns off. It's like on, off. That's the only two functions. Whereas in this, there's the idea of a power setting and a thickness setting for the lightsaber. And now when I read it for the first time, you're like, no, that's not how lightsaber, it's like obvious how lightsabers work, because it's so obvious, you know, they're just there, and they're so well known, you know. It's in the same way that when someone says, you know, the Force is actually by midichlorians in the bloodstream, and everyone goes, no, it's not, it's a power between that infuses everything living, and there's a dark side, and light, you know, that kind of thing. But a lightsaber is become that iconic, and when you find out that there was actually a little dial setting on the side, and you can turn it down, and you can make it so thin that it can fit between a door, and then you can unlock doors with a lightsaber, and now lightsabers are like this, a more elegant weapon from a more elegant time, or whatever the quote is. I'm not very good at quoting all of Star Wars. But then you find out, oh, actually, you can use it to pick locks, and you can turn down the power setting, and it can become something really, really thin. So that was a strange thing. The another thing that comes up is that Leia, it's said that what makes her fight is because the Empire has been it's been stifling freedom and stifling the arts, and she was getting into art, and then she found out that the Empire was stifling free expression, I think is the quote, something like long established totalitarian regime stifling free expression is what came but that's what sort of like got her going and made her join the Rebel Alliance. And I thought that was quite interesting that Alan Dean Foster, after watching Star Wars, he saw the Empire as this long established, and it seems to be set like in a splinter of the mind's eye. It seemed to go back like generations. Like this has been in place a long, 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 long time. Like maybe like the Roman Empire went back, but before that there was a Senate. But we find out in Star Wars, A New Hope, that they've just dissolved the Senate and it's the Death Star that can keep everyone in line. Whereas it seems like in this book, like the Death Star, yeah, sure, that was handy to keep everything in line, but really the totalitarian control of the Empire was there even without the Senate, because I don't think the Senate is mentioned that much. So it seems like the Empire had been set in, it was in place a lot, lot longer than is sort of like viewed in the prequels. And also Darth Vader still has a guy over him. Like in Star Wars, there's Tarkin. Is it Moff Tarkin? Grand Moff Tarkin. He's kind of Darth Vader's boss, and he sends him out on different missions. And in this book, Empire Strikes Back, Darth Vader kind of gets his own free way, and he sort of roams around the thing. And then now he's in charge. It's like, yes, we will go, you know, we will take this the Star Destroyer in over here through this asteroid field. And he's calling all the shots then, because it's like Tarkin got out of the way. And now, you know, Vader has sort of like free reign throughout the entire of the Empire's of the troops, and through the command structure he can kind of step in wherever he wants to, and the only person above him now is really the Emperor. It's like it's a 1-2. But in Splinter of the Mind's Eye, nope, there's a guy called General or something Asada, and he's the guy who is I just read my notes and R2-D2 is underneath Vader. Yeah, so he's the one who sends Vader on missions. The next note that I have here is that Luke understands R2-D2 without any translation. In A New Hope, he always had to have C-3PO around to understand him. And then in Empire Strikes Back, when he's flying around and R2-D2's with him, he has a little translator widget kind of gadget thing on the X-wing dashboard there. And he looks at it and he goes, "No, R2, I'm not going to give you control for us to go and meet up with the Rendezvous. We're going to Hoth. No, not going to Hoth. We're going to Dagobah. We're going from Hoth to Dagobah." And he flies there by himself and doesn't let R2 take over. And he knows that R2 wants to take over because he's got a little translation widget. And then when they land on Dagobah, he doesn't have that, so he doesn't understand really what's going on, and R2-D2 is having to communicate just by acting rather than by his words, which is maybe the reason, a little bit of apologetics here, but this might be the reason when R2-D2 meets Yoda for the first time, he might be going, "Hey, Luke, this is Yoda. This is Master Yoda. I know this guy. I met him back in episode one, you know, when we met in Qui-Gon Jinn's funeral. That was the first time we were ever on screen together. I know this guy. Look, him, there, that's who you're looking for." He could have been doing that, but he was just a bad actor and Luke didn't understand it because he didn't have his translation widget. Maybe that's one way to fill that plot hole. In Splinter of the Mind's Eye, Luke just understands R2-D2. Maybe he learnt that machine language and doesn't need C-3PO to translate, even though C-3PO is there most of the time. And also, Darth Vader didn't know who blew up the Death Star. And there seems to be a bit of a question. It's like, you're the one. You know, Darth Vader is, of course, not Luke's father. I mean, that's very, very clear here. They have a totally different history, totally separate history that hasn't even come up to it. None of that backstory exists. None of that future story exists, and all the relationship between there. He doesn't even know who he is. He's just like, now I sense the Force in you. You're the same guy who blew up the Death Star. But I think he gets it mixed up. Here on Wikipedia it says, during the lightsaber fight between Luke and Darth Vader, Vader states that he knows Luke is the pilot that shot him out of the way during the Death Star trench run, when it in fact was Han Solo in the Millennium Falcon. And I think this bit on Wikipedia, maybe I'm just misremembering it because I did read this book a few weeks ago. I finished this book a few weeks ago, but I think he doesn't say that, "Hey, you shot me during the Death Star." I think it's more of a, "You shot at the Death Star and blew it up." Maybe. I'm not entirely sure. What else have we got here in my notes that I kept as I came through here? Oh yeah, it's things that we use later. There's you can see actually this book probably was quite influential when Alan Dean Foster wrote this book, and then you had the whole like okay, so instead of it being right, let's just discard this book completely and go with Plan A for the high budget film adaptation. Well, not of this book, but, you know, the whole new story that was being told. George Lucas obviously read this book and probably had quite a lot of ideas that he wanted the later directors and writers of the original trilogy to use. So, for example, the planet where this is all set on is a big swamp planet, which is very, very reminiscent of Dagobah. You've got, like, the monsters coming out of the swamp. Luke crash lands his X-Wing fighter here in the very beginning of this book, very much like he does in The Empire Strikes Back. The entire action sequence, sort of like big battle sequence at the end of Splinter of the Mind's Eye, are these small furry Ewok-like creatures, and they're in caves, not in big trees, but in caves underground, and they use all of their, you know, spears and little things, and they roll rocks down onto the stormtroopers. It's actually more believable in this book than it is in the Return of the Jedi, because I always think that's one of the, you know, it's fun, and when I was a kid, I really enjoyed having like seeing the rocks rolling down the hill and the logs rolling down the hill and knocking over the stormtroopers and their walking machines, the Imperial walkers, is it the AT-ATs? I can't remember. And so that's all going on there, and really good fun. But that is taken very, very much from this battle at the end, even to the point where you've got these small furry creatures, these little aboriginal creatures, and fighting stormtroopers using rocks and bows and arrows and spears and all those kind of things, plus having a small group of Rebel Alliance kind of people. In this case, it's Luke and Leia and some big Wookiee kind of creatures whose names I can't remember, or race I can't remember, but a big Wookiee-like creatures sort of fighting alongside them and kind of directing them and doing that kind of thing. So that's also very, very clear. And also there is the scene in the final confrontation of this book. Luke chops off Vader's arm and Vader falls down a big hole. And of course that's a weird thing to say, because you all know, no, wait a second, it's the other way around. Vader chops off Luke's arm, but the whole idea of chopping off of the hand, sure, that happens throughout, you know. Luke chops Vader chops Luke's hand off, and then in Return of the Jedi Luke chops Vader's arm off there. And then I think Count Dooku cuts off, I can't even remember. So it's been so long since I've seen episode 2, but I think it's Count Dooku chops off Anakin's arm, and then later on Obi-Wan Kenobi chops off Anakin's other arm and other arm and carry on like that. So the whole chopping off the hand to showing mastery and to showing moving like differences the transition of high status and low status and who you think is going to win. The chopping off the hand is very symbolic in this movie series, and maybe it came from this novel, The Splinter of the Mind's Eye. So there you go. I think that's all I'm going to talk about this, because it's really not, I didn't read it as a book to enjoy as a novel. I read it as kind of a research thing, and there will be some other novels that might pop up here in the feed, some other Star Wars novels set that were written after the original trilogy, set before the original trilogy, but came out before the chronologically set before the original trilogy, but came out afterwards, but before the prequels. I know that's a bit confusing, but that's the kind of thing that I need to just check up on. And each of these things, you know, in my final book project, which is going to be called Matthew, Mark, Luke, Skywalker, where I do contrast these kind of things. All of the stuff that I just said in this podcast will only be like a little bit of one chapter, or like half of one chapter about this topic. But it's actually very fun to be writing this project and researching this project. I'm doing a lot of non-fiction reading, so partly about Star Wars, but also mostly about the Bible and some other history things. the Odyssey is quite interesting at the at the moment. Not from a Star Wars point of view, more of a biblical kind of view. Kind of falls outside of the this thing. So I'm going to wrap this book up. Oh, I could talk about like the normal things about the setting of the world, but you don't need to know all that kind of thing. I could talk about the themes of this book, but there isn't. This is like if there's ever a book written without any kind of thematic content in mind, it is a tie-in novel written to be a low-budget sequel to Star Wars, which was then abandoned for a higher budget storyline, which is the kind of story that George Lucas actually wanted to tell. This is like so far away from any thematic exploration of anything, unlike the Star Wars original trilogy, which I think is an amazing exploration of so many themes. This book just falls short in so many ways, it's hardly even worth talking about. So I'm going to just wrap it up and give this book 1.5 stars as a novel, maybe 3 stars as a historical curiosity. But me just talking about it here is pretty much all you need to know about this novel. Read the Wikipedia page and read some other people's reviews. It's really not worth reading this book. So as a novel, 1.5 stars. But that's really not being fair, because I didn't even read it to enjoy it, even though I did enjoy it a little bit. There is a little bit to enjoy. Oh, one thing to like to say is, if you read the Kindle version, there's these, I've not read many Kindle ebooks. Normally I read them on some other things. So you get here, it says you're 58% of the book. There's like these different, there's down at the bottom of each page, there's 3 different ways to indicate how far you are through the book. So it says you're 58% of the way through the book, and you're like, ah. And then it says you're on page 277 of 298, and you're like, wow, that's not 57% of the way, that's like really near the end. And then it says location 3,529 of 6,112. So you're thinking, well, that's more like the 58%. And then I realized that the percentage and the location are for the entire Kindle ebook file, which is what I'm actually reading here, and the pages are actually page numbers, which I guess are marked in some metadata somewhere of like, if you were reading the paper book, you would currently be on this page, which is very handy to actually see that. But I got mixed up, and I was like thinking I still had half of this book to go when I was getting to, well, like page 50%, but the story seemed to be wrapping up to this big confrontation between Luke and Vader, and the love story of Leia and Luke, Leia and Luke, I guess, is a better way of saying it. That was weird. But it still said I had 40% of the book left. And it turns out that at the end of the book, you actually get, let me see here. So book extras, you get like another, not book extras. Table of contents. Let me have a look here. So you get 12 chapters of this book. Then you get about the author, also by this author, introduction to the Star Wars Expanded Universe, excerpt from Star Wars the Thrawn trilogy, Heir to the Empire, introduction to the Old Republic, introduction to the Rise of the Empire era, introduction to the Rebellion era, introduction to the New Republic era, introduction to the New Jedi Order. I've not actually looked through these things, but I guess it's like just background of history, which was written at the time. I'm not even quite sure what all this is, because I didn't look through it, because I'm really not interested enough to read another novel's worth of introductions to different sort of like introduction to the legacy Star Wars novels timeline. I guess it goes, oh, okay, so you can see where the different books fit in the overall timeline. Yeah, there's one here. Oh, 1,032 years. Darth Maul, Saboteur, Cloak of Deception, Darth Maul, Shadow Hunter. So I guess that's Darth Maul's. I've not actually read any of these things, I've read very few tie-in novels. But it was good to read this one, I guess. So that's it for me. Thanks a lot for listening. I've got another 2 books that I've already finished, and another series of books that I've finished as well. So I'm going to be reviewing soon a book called Wool, which is a collection of short stories, which I also read as a Kindle ebook more recently on this last trip that I did. And also the Book of the New Sun. I've read the final, all of those books now, the quartet of books, plus the Earth of the New Sun, which came after it, and I've read all of them, and I will get to a review of the entire series at some point and talk about that too. But I think I might go back and listen to the audiobook of the first novel, the Shadow of the Torturer, again, just because I read the other main series as audiobooks, or listen to them as audiobooks, and I'd like to listen to that one as audiobooks to have the complete set and just to sort of pick up the start of the story, which I first read a few years ago, to make sure I haven't forgotten anything. So that's it from me. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.